TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Collapse and the Technosphere with Dmitry Orlov. In recent research for TUC programs on climate change, the school strike movement, and Extinction Rebellion, ideas around collapse have been coming up. They may be expressed by scientists or novelists and include familiar names, such as James Howard Koestler and John Michael Greer. One person stands out, Dmitry Orlov, and you will now hear a conversation with him. It was conducted by James on his Hermetics podcast on August 31, 2019. James' first question brings about the memory of the Mongol Empire and makes a surprising connection between democracy and the amazingly large and long-lived empire that began in the 13th century. James will now introduce you to Dmitry Orlov.
This week, I am joined by Dmitry Orlov, who is a Russian engineer and writer whose work is based around collapse, technology, and politics. He is the author of multiple books, including Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, and The Five Stages of Collapse, A Survivor's Toolkit. We will be discussing his book, Shrinking the Technosphere. Enjoy. Dmitry Orlov, thanks for coming on to the Hermetics podcast.
Great to be with you.
As per this podcast, the first question is the Hermetics question, which is if you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation, whom do you pick?
Well, I'm not a big fan of fantasy sports, but I suppose one outstanding question I have is why does everybody believe that democratic institutions are so good when all that ever happens with them is they degenerate into a kleptocracy? And so who would I ask? I suppose the original Democrat in my mind is Genghis Khan. He was the first person who arrived at a democratic structure for the world's largest land empire of all time. So I'd have him along. And then a good practitioner would, I suppose, be Niccolo Machiavelli. And then I'd ask an American along, Thomas Jefferson, and I would ask them that question. Why does everybody feel that democracy is valuable when all that ever happens with democratic institutions is they swiftly degenerate into a kleptocracy where a tiny minority fleeces the rest?
So if we were to stay on that topic, why do you personally think that people are extremely almost reverent of democracy in general?
Well, I don't know that they're reverent. It's just that there is this consensus, it would seem. I think it's based on something that Churchill said, that democracy is the worst system except for all the others. And that seems to be a consensus. It's very hard to get anywhere with people by telling them that, well, you know, democratic institutions don't really work, so let's try something else. It's just a non-starter. And it's just an observation. It's not something I think, it's something I observe.
So a tiny bit about your biography or your history here, for those that don't know your work. And I think the important aspect is that the two things I see as making your collapse analysis unique is one, that you sort of experienced and written about the experiences of the end of the Soviet Union in relation to collapse, and two, in terms of technology, you're not a Luddite, you're not anti-technology, and you're not hearkening back to some form of archaic nostalgia. You wish to wrestle with technology. These are the two things I see as kind of unique to your viewpoint here. Perhaps you could extrapolate just a little about your history, especially in terms of the Soviet Union there.
Well, I was born in Russia. I grew up there. Well, Russia didn't exist at the time. That was the Russian Federative Soviet Socialist Republic. And I moved to the United States together with my family as a teenager, went through school and university in the United States, worked in the United States, had several careers. And at the first opportunity, I started going back to what became Russia. Well, first I went back to the Soviet Union in 89, but in subsequent years it was I was going back to Russia, Russian Federation. And during the 90s, I observed the transformation that took place there. And that got me thinking, how is the United States different? What I saw in the Soviet Union and in Russia was that the system that was entrenched and still functioning was becoming dangerously depleted at every level, starting with being unable to maintain the physical plant and equipment that supported the whole thing, to being unable to replace the elites that ran the system with same caliber human material. I started thinking, well, why has the Soviet Union collapsed but the United States still hasn't? Part of that answer was that the Soviet Union collapsed first, and that gave the United States a new lease on life, because what happened in the 90s was wholesale looting of everything that wasn't nailed down in the former Soviet Union. All that wealth went west. It was basically just looted. So that was one of the reasons for the postponement. There were several others. But generally, I started looking at the Soviet template and applying it, or trying to apply it, to the United States and the West in general, but mostly to the United States. And it turned out that the Soviet Union was inadvertently much better prepared for collapse than the United States is or ever will be. And that collapse, when it comes in the United States, will be far more destructive than what happened in the Soviet Union or in Russia.
And I believe I'm correct in thinking that, and this is one of the things you you make clear in Reinventing Collapse, that the reasons the Soviet Union was far more prepared for collapse was because the population there already almost had to deal with collapse anyway. Hardly anyone was making ends meet, so they had to find these skills and teach themselves these skills, not as kind of additional extras like they would be currently in the US, but literally because they had to live. So as John Michael Greer, you know, he calls it the long descent. America is within the long descent, but it's just kind of just about holding itself up and not recognizing the problems there. Whereas do you think the people in Russia kind of knew, like, this is coming to an end?
Well, there are differences. Well, first of all, the positives that Russia had with regard to collapse was that it could collapse without hurting the systems very much that kept people alive. So even without a running economy, because it was a command and control economy rather than a market economy, people still had electricity, they still had running water, there was still heat in the houses, public transportation kept running. There was still some kind of food in the stores, although that part of the system collapsed relatively quickly. But there were stockpiles still. Some parts of agriculture kept running, so you could still get staples. There was free medical care, even though access to pharmaceuticals wasn't very good at various times. But people still could get their bones set, and infants were delivered without anybody having to pay for it. So those were all benefits that the United States does not have. In the United States, if you run out of money, you're pretty much just out on the street digging through garbage. There was some of that happening in Russia, but not as much, at the worst of times, not as much as is happening routinely in the United States today. The homelessness crisis just didn't really hit Russia at all. It's rampant in the U.S. already, even pre-collapse. And then the other huge benefit that Russia had was a very highly educated populace that turned out to be extremely resourceful. Once they realized that they had to start doing things very differently and shifting for themselves, they did start shifting for themselves. It didn't help matters that the government was just incredibly corrupt and surrendered its sovereignty to the United States, mostly the European Union to some extent. But they clawed it back under Putin. And so now you have a good combination of, well-educated people basically managing their own affairs rather well within a market economy this time, without a lot of dependence on outside forces.
Perhaps I'm being a bit stereotypical towards the ideology of Soviet Union here, but do you find there's a little bit of an irony there that against the communist ideology that people had to go... I had to become actually very almost individualist, or was there still a form of community there that was separate from the ideology?
Well, individualism still doesn't get you very far in Russia on a social level. People still do depend on each other here to a great extent, and the traditions of solidarity do appear to hold in a lot of cases, and you know, that's very helpful. As far as the communist ideology, that died sometime during World War II, I think. Anyway, you know, basically, you know, once Lenin was dead and Trotsky was in exile and then dead, you were left with Stalin, and Stalin was not really a communist. I don't know if anybody really appreciates that, but he used capitalist methods to achieve, you know, socialist victories. None of that had to do with communism. And only after Stalin died did some of that came back because of these quote-unquote Ukrainians that went into power, which was Khrushchev and then Brezhnev. And they started talking up, you know, international duty. So the reason the Soviet Union blundered into Afghanistan was to preserve world revolution in some sense. And, you know, that was just the system kind of degenerating. But the public understanding was that the ideology was just this tired old bunch of stuff that people were forced to study and repeat. There was no life to it.
Okay. Do you think that anywhere in the world since Lenin and Trotsky there has been a legitimate kind of communist ideology which people are supportive of as a nation?
Well, Cuba made a try of it, but Cuba is really just socialism with market elements. I mean, that's the only system that works in the world, anywhere in the world, is socialism with market elements.
Is that
that's
what you,
all there is?
Is that what you'd consider America then, socialism with market elements?
It's incredibly corrupt socialism with incredibly corrupt market elements, yes. But it's basically, America is unique in that it's generally just eating itself alive. You know, it's a bunch of rackets, as Kunstler likes to put it. And I agree with him. America at this point is just a bunch of rackets.
Okay. I'm sure we'll dip back into a few of those political things there. But just to begin on the kind of collapse and the technology front, and I'm sure you've answered this question quite a few times now, a few of the discussions I've listened to. But if I could just ask you it, a kind of a brief definition of what it is that you entitled the technosphere.
Well, I wrote that book a while ago. It did rather badly commercially for a couple of different reasons. One is that I published it just as Trump got elected. And in the book, I failed to demonize Trump, which made me unpopular with the quote-unquote liberal readership, which was quite a large percentage of it. So a lot of people, you know, bought the book, found out that I was saying positive things about Russia as opposed to claiming that Russia stole the election or some stupid thing like that, and returned it. So it didn't really get very far. And the other thing is that in the book, I expect people to consider changing what they do. Actually, you know, I expected people to do some work, and that's really not a winning move. Expecting people to do something is generally a bad idea. Expecting people to do less is generally a big winner. Any great idea that allows you to just sit there and do nothing is going to be popular. So on those two fronts, it really didn't do well. But I sort of stuck with the subject and explored it some more. And sometime later, I discovered a great Russian thinker by the name of Lev Gumilev, who did a lot of research along these lines. It turns out the term technosphere was coined early in the 20th century by another great Russian thinker by the name of Vernadsky, a scientist who was the instigator of the Russian, not Soviet, but Russian pre-revolutionary nuclear research program. It was thanks to him that when the Soviet Union became threatened with American nuclear bombs, they could come up with their own nuclear bombs in record time because they already had a program running. They already had stockpiles of material, etc. But anyway, he came up with the term technosphere. and then Gumilev expanded on it and came up with this triad, which is we have the biosphere of the Earth, all of the living things within it, and then we have a sort of emergent entity within the biosphere, which is humanity, but not of the sort of humanity that sleeps on bare ground naked and digs around for tubers with a stick, but humanity that, you know, creates, builds pyramids and creates empires and conquers the world and invents sailing ships and all of this other stuff. And it turns out that there's a process that gives rise to communities of people who are capable of more than just bare survival. He called the process ethnogenesis and had a lot to say on the subject by looking at all of the examples of ethnogenesis from the last 6,000 years or so. And then the technosphere is what ethnogenesis creates. It is the universe of man-made things, which is unlike the biosphere. All it ever does is degenerate. You build it and it falls apart. You build it again and it falls apart. And we're in kind of the late stages of the technosphere now, where it is very highly developed and you can't tell whether it's being built or whether it's falling apart. Competencies are going missing left and right, while new competencies, such as making smartphones even smarter, are zooming ahead for what that's worth. So it's very interesting to look at the world through that prism as that triad and examine the various facets of it.
So what would you say the difference there then, because you say that the technosphere only degenerates, what would you say the difference with regards to entropy would be between the biosphere and the technosphere?
Well, the biosphere basically is all based on flows, energy flows that are driven by solar energy and some chemical energy, but mostly just solar energy. So it can achieve steady state for long durations, and it's also self-adjusting. So as the climate shifts, certain species do worse, and you know, other species go extinct and something else evolves. It doesn't really involve a lot of or any human intervention. Whereas the technosphere, if it's not being maintained, it really falls apart. Every last bit of it, you know, even the pyramids are slowly being weathered away, even though they were meant to last forever, but nothing that humans build can last forever. It's all temporary because it's all based on the technosphere.
And you say in your book that this the technosphere is not only a demon, but you specifically allude to it being a demiurge. And I really enjoyed this turn of phrase. Was there a specific reason you called it a demiurge?
Well, I basically tried to appeal to the sensibilities of people who can't think of an emergent system because that doesn't mean anything to them. So a lot of people are more comfortable thinking in terms of a demonic entity or a spirit than just a mechanism that is so advanced and complicated that it shows, it demonstrates some limited ability to reason and actually manifests its own will and can formulate its own agenda. That's a stretch for a lot of people, so I use those terms more as a crutch than anything else.
Okay, so in kind of specific scientific terms, it would be an emergent system.
It's an emergent system.
Okay. Are you sympathetic to the spiritual views, or are you spiritual at all?
Well, yes. That entire realm is, you know, extremely important and completely unrelated to the subject matter.
So the teleology of the technosphere, its endgame, it's the point that it's kind of grasping towards in the future. You say this is control. And I think we can say that that's the technosphere's aims unto itself. But can this really be answered to us? Do you think, can we truly say that what the teleology for the technosphere for itself is, or are we, would that just be conjecture?
Well, imagine it as a robot or an artificial intelligence network. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have taste or touch or human sight. It has certain analytical tools. It can perform certain measurements, right? It can take a photograph and then distill certain elements from it. It can use facial recognition, or it can map lines or contours on a photograph, aerial photograph or satellite photo, and derive from it a map. It has access to a great deal of statistical data, so it can perform various types of analysis. But that is all it can do. It doesn't have any human sensibility. It doesn't have any sort of instinct or any emotional intelligence. And so what it can do is it can control various processes that are within its control. It can, for instance, allow or deny access to credit. That's one of the functions that it is generally absorbing into itself, because it's much better than human analysts. And there are various other functions that it can perform, but all of them are based on this idea of complete control based on incomplete information, because nobody ever has access to complete information. And that is its undoing, I think. It tries to control things more and more tightly. And in the process, it destroys whatever it is it tries to control, because it doesn't have access to complete information.
And this is one of the things you really emphasize in the book, that the reason the technosphere and specifically humans kind of almost don't get along, or at least the technosphere doesn't get along with the humans, is because the technosphere adores standardization, and humans in general, at least before being kind of assimilated into the technosphere, are spontaneous and intuitive and free in a certain way, at least when they're children. And so this is one of the things you say that the technosphere does from day one, really, is find ways to standardize existence.
Well, not all standardization is bad. For instance, if you have standard glass containers for dairy products that you wash yourself and bring to the shops empty, and they're filled by placing them on the scale and measuring out whatever it is you want to buy, then you don't have to deal with recycling a huge number of plastic and paper containers. So that's a victory. On the other hand, if what's being standardized is human brains, children's brains, by forcing them to study for standardized tests, okay? Mm-hmm. That is definitely bad, because who needs standardized brains? We need the opposite of standardized brains. So it's a question of who's in charge. You know, if you have basically an out-of-control market economy where either you go with the flow or you go broke, and then the technosphere is basically in charge. You defy the technosphere and you go bankrupt. Whereas if the economy is really controlled using an agenda that is based on the production of public goods and on an appreciation of what the common good is, where the profit motive is forced to take a backseat, then the technosphere is not in charge. Humanity is in charge, and humanity makes use of the technosphere. It's a question of who is riding whom, you see. Do we allow the technosphere to ride us, or do we ride it?
And there's hundreds of clear ways now where it's riding us, and I mean ruining our neuroplasticity from day one and molding us into kind of attention-drained automatons. And do you think, as a way to kind of almost push back, or as you say, shrink the technosphere, we should begin to form again a more realist understanding of suffering and death?
Well, that is a question of culture, and I think the West, the US and the UK, and probably a lot of Western Europe, has gone very far in the direction of sort of putting everyone in hospice care, even while they're still relatively healthy. Sort of, you know, keep everyone sedated so they don't struggle, because there's nothing for them to look forward to. So you might as well just hand out drugs and whatever, and make sure that nobody is offended with anything or forced to think, because thought is so painful, you know, unless you think a lot when you're forced to think about something, especially when you're forced to consider two contradictory notions at the same time. My God, for unpracticed people, that just makes their heads explode. So don't do that. You know, just keep everyone comfortable and sedated until it's all over. That seems to be the approach. But that's not how the rest of the world functions. There are large parts of the world where thinking is just completely verboten. I think There are a lot of places in the world where you're just basically repeating what everyone else says, or you're in trouble automatically. And then there are other places in the world that are renowned for tolerance of just every kind of thinking, where there's no internal censorship whatsoever. And that can be good or bad, but that's what I prefer.
I'm going to ask, which places do you think are, do you see as those places who are that are completely tolerant of any opinion or internal thought?
Russia is definitely one of those places these days. It's extreme in terms of its embrace of freedom of speech. You can get away with anything in Russia except libel and incitement to violence.
Why do you think that is?
Because it would be far more expensive to repress than to simply allow. And the government has enough on its plate that it's just not going to bother.
That was the first part of an hour-long conversation between James and his Hermetics podcast and Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry Orlov is a Russian-American engineer and writer on subjects related to potential economic, ecological, and political decline and collapse in the United States. Something he has called permanent crisis. When Orlov's book, Everything's Going According to Plan, was published in 2017, he wrote, "A little over 21 years ago, I determined for myself how this story's going to end, but kept my mouth shut. Then around 2000, I sensed a change in the wind and wrote the article, Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century, which launched my writing career. Since then, I have published several books and hundreds of essays. But I stand by everything I have written since the very beginning. Everything is going according to plan. I don't know whose plan it is. And I think that's a really stupid plan. But everything is going according to it anyway. I hope that knowing what the plan is will save you and those around you from a great deal of senseless aggravation." End quote. Dmitry Orlov continues to write almost weekly on his Club Orlov blog. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the second half of the hour-long conversation. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.